Derek, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Have you ever been duped by a deepfake?
I mean, maybe. It's certainly possible. I like to think that maybe less so than others, but you know, the best deepfakes are the ones you don't realize are fake.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'll cop to the fact that I think the original Obama deepfake back in the day got to me.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about deepfakes today. You have a great story that just went up on the site on election officials in Arizona and Minnesota getting trained on how to respond to deepfakes being used to influence the election. We'll be talking about that. And we've also got an interview today with Kirsten Todd, who I don't think I'm off base in saying might be one of the most influential behind-the-scenes players on cybersecurity in Washington, D.C. We'll have an interview with her on the show coming up today on Safe Mode.
Welcome to Safe Mode. I'm Elias Grohl, Senior Editor at Cyberscoop. Every week, we break down the most pressing issues in technology, provide you the knowledge and the tools to stay ahead of the latest threats, and take you behind the scenes of the biggest stories in cybersecurity.
An attack is coming.
It's about keeping us safe.
He's just a disgruntled hacker.
She's a super hacker. Stay alert.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
This is Safe Mode.
I'm the host of Safe Mode, Elias Grohl. I'm joined today by Derek Johnson, Cyberscoop reporter. Welcome back to the show, Derek. It's been a minute since you were here.
Yeah. Glad to be back.
Since you were last on the show, you've been reporting out a story on how election workers are trying to prepare for how AI might be used to disrupt the election in 2024. And in particular, looking at some trainings that are being carried out. Talk us through a little bit how election workers are getting ready for the fall.
You know, as I've sort of talked to election officials this year, and particularly since the New Hampshire robocall, the number one concern that I consistently hear has been around deepfakes, which I think is notable because that certainly wasn't necessarily the case in past election cycles. There are so many other problems and issues and challenges that election officials have that it is notable that, you know, this has been really the most popular response when I ask what's your top concern. And you know, a lot of them told me it doesn't present a new threat per se, but it can sort of dramatically and exponentially amplify a lot of the disinformation that we already see, while also kind of messing with our perceptions of reality around things like video, audio, imagery. And so with that in mind, I really wanted to learn more about what state and local officials, as well as, you know, sort of third-party election security groups were doing to try to prepare jurisdictions for this November. And oftentimes the answer that I got was that they were working on developing new trainings and tabletop exercises that would hopefully leave election officials more prepared come November. And so in Arizona, for example, which was really hammered in 2020 by disinformation during the Stop the Steal movement, the Secretary of State's office actually put in place a specific tabletop exercise in December. They brought state, local, federal officials, as well as tech and AI companies and some third-party groups like the Brennan Center for Justice together in one room. They were able to run simulations. They educated officials on the nature of the threat. And most interestingly, I think they actually created deepfakes of their own of state election officials and other parties to really sort of demonstrate in a really visceral way what these technologies are capable of. And so they told me that it wasn't until they were actually prompted by the organizers about it that they realized some of these videos were fake.
Yeah, so I want to get into that. So in this December training that we're talking about here in Arizona, state election workers were presented with a deepfake video of Arizona's Secretary of State. Were they able to detect that this state official with whom they are quite familiar, who was speaking to them via video, was in fact a deepfake?
So what I was told is that many of the audience members, which again were composed of election officials, were not aware that this was anything more than just a routine introductory video by the Secretary of State. Adrian Fontes, until they were told by organizers, which sort of tracks, I think, with some of the claims we saw that came out of the New Hampshire robocall, where folks who are not necessarily familiar intimately with this technology aren't going to necessarily pick up on the cues and the miscues that let you know these are fake.
Yeah, I think for folks who are, you know, deep or in tech world or who are interested in, you know, the tech story of the day, that, you know, being AI, right? I think we're aware of what the possibilities are, but I don't think that the same can be said about election workers who are on the front lines of this issue. Well, one of the things that struck me in your story was, you know, some of the comments from the kind of longtime election officials talking about the changing responsibilities that election officials now face. I'm wondering if you might kind of describe a little bit how the role of election workers is changing and how they're now also having to deal with AI.
Yeah, this is really something that has been steadily building since 2016, when we first saw Russia wage a really coordinated and substantial campaign to influence the 2016 election. That was really the first time where cybersecurity, the security of your voter registration systems, the presence of disinformation and hack and leak campaigns, all of that was dumped in the 2016 election. And in America, you know, there is a federal role for elections, but this stuff is largely handled by the state and local officials. Elections weren't even designated critical infrastructure by the federal government until after 2016. That really kicked off this whole notion that, you know, you're not just worried about voter rolls and keeping those clean and engaging voters and educating voters and running polling places. Now you have to be a cybersecurity expert. And as disinformation and AI have gotten more and more sophisticated, and as other entities like the federal government, as well as tech and social media companies, have sort of pulled back on being more aggressive about their own disinformation missions, a lot of this stuff has been dumped again on state and local officials who are doing their best, but they're dealing with a lot of turnover. They're dealing with threats and harassment. It's a lot to expect for folks who have a lot of other existing challenges.
So for folks who are working on preparing for the AI threat in the election in the fall, election officials, state level election officials in particular, what do they think is possible in terms of preparing for this? Like, what concretely do they think that they can actually do at this point?
So there's one of the things that I heard over and over again is that there's really nothing you can do sort of left of boom per se, sort of before. Like, if someone wants to do this, if someone wants to create a deep fake of you, it takes incredibly small amounts of training material, whether it's audio, whether it's video. Audio is a lot easier than video, is what I've been learning. But it's just so easy. You know, if you're an election official and you've spoken at a town council meeting or you've been on a TV interview, most likely bad actors have much of the information that they need to impersonate you. And this can be done both in the way that we saw voters get targeted in the New Hampshire robocall, but there's also a concern that this stuff could be targeted more in one-on-one type conversations with election officials. You could get a call from someone claiming to be your boss or the Secretary of State, someone you know that you have a trusted relationship with, telling you, hey, there's a change of plans. I need you to give me your voter registration password, or I need you to go off script for what the protocol is here, because we have this developing situation. Both of those scenarios, I think, really concern election officials and could facilitate, more shenanigans downstream that could impact elections.
Yeah, it seems it's really all about being quick on your toes, being ready to communicate in the event of a deepfake being used, and knowing what you're going to do, like, once that moment comes, right?
Yeah, and that's sort of what, I mean, that's kind of what Kathy Sullivan, who was the Democratic Party official who had her phone number or her husband's phone number spoofed in the New Hampshire robocall, told me after that happened, which was she really credited sort of the speed and the fast coordination that they were able to do both internally, both in terms of connecting with folks who had gotten the call, connecting with law enforcement, connecting with media, filing a complaint. All of that happened before the actual primary happened. And that was, you know, she at least felt that that was critical in terms of debunking it ahead of time and reducing its effect. But I also talked to other folks who, you know, election officials who sort of pointed out that, like, you know, you could see things like this dropped much, much closer to an election day in a way that makes it much harder to respond. And so I think that having sort of a communications plan in place, having pre-established relationships with your local and federal law enforcement, and having good connections with the media and other outlets that can spread the word as soon as possible, those are really kind of the best defenses that we have right now. Detection technologies and other things can help, but they're not a panacea.
Yeah. All right, Derek, thanks so much for your great reporting on this. We'll have the link to your full story on this for folks who are interested. And I'm sure you'll be back on the show soon to talk about more election-related shenanigans. Derek, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up next on Safe Mode, I'm joined by Kirsten Todd, who's worked across the U.S. government on cybersecurity issues and was most recently the chief of staff at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. My interview with Kirsten Todd is up next on Safe Mode. Joining me today is Kirsten Todd, currently the CEO of Liberty Group Ventures. Kirsten Todd has worked on just about every hot-button cybersecurity issue you can imagine. As a Senate staffer, she drafted key parts of the legislation that created the Department of Homeland Security. During the Obama years, she was the executive director of the Commission on Enhancing National Cybersecurity. And her most recent role in government was as the chief of staff at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, a position she stepped down from a year ago. Kirsten Todd, welcome to Safe Mode.
Thanks so much, Elias. Great to be with you.
So we're recording this interview on March 6th, and as we speak, healthcare providers in the U.S. are struggling to get paid. Many of them are because of a ransomware attack on the company Change Healthcare. Change is one of these companies that are crucial to the healthcare industry, but which most people probably have never heard of. Its systems touch something like 1 in 3 patient records in America. And anyone who's been paying attention to cybersecurity issues over the past decade will know that, you know, folks have been clamoring to get the healthcare industry to improve its cybersecurity practices. Still, nonetheless, here we are with American healthcare providers facing serious cash flow pressures because of a ransomware attack, right? I'm wondering if you might step back as someone who's, you know, looked at this industry and consider, how did we get to this point?
Yeah, well, it's incredibly tragic when lives are put at risk. And this is the evolution of cybersecurity, because for a long time, we saw how cyber was affecting businesses, but always with a detached notion of impact. And now we're seeing actors really go after individuals, go after critical infrastructure that impacts the lives and livelihood of people. And healthcare, last year, CISA identified sort of three really important sectors that they identified as target-rich, resource-poor: water, healthcare, and education, while not a sector, just looking at the K-12 schools. And this is because these are entities, these are organizations that have a mission that, while cybersecurity helps the mission grow, their focus is on protecting lives and ensuring healthcare and ensuring everybody gets their prescriptions. But they often don't have the resources to invest in cybersecurity. And so the whole of government approach here and the sector specific support is so critical. Right now, we've got to look at healthcare, not just from what's happening at the local level, but this is an opportunity for the Department of Health and Human Services, for the Health Sector Coordinating Council, these entities, to really get in and create much more of an infrastructure of support and resilience by ensuring that the basics are being done. The challenge is that ransomware actors, there have always been opportunistic, but there's an even greater level of ruthlessness, because when a life is on the line, you're not going to debate 24, 36, you know, 48 hours on whether or not you should be paying ransom. You need to make sure that people are protected. And the other piece, what we've heard about the impact, is people not getting prescriptions and just these reverberating effects. So as you said, you know, we've been following this, but now it's how do you get the resources and raising the baseline for these particular sectors that really impact the day-to-day lives and health of everybody?
I think the point about healthcare the healthcare sector being target rich and resource poor is a good one. But I think the fact that Change Healthcare is being targeted in this instance is very interesting. Change Healthcare is a subsidiary of United Health Group, one of the biggest countries in America by revenue. This is not a resource poor company that's being targeted. This is an extremely lucrative company that's being targeted. What do you think that says about the healthcare industry? The fact that, you know, you've got a company with massive revenues getting hit.
I think this cuts across every sector, and it's a great point in the distinction that we're still not seeing the type of vigilance and diligence and governance piece to cybersecurity for large businesses that we should be seeing, whether it's MGM, whether it's Clorox. We continue to see vulnerabilities. And it's not to say that you're going to protect yourself against everything, but certainly the vulnerabilities and the types of compromises that we're seeing that are so impactful have to be mitigated. One of the elements of the rewrite of the NIST voluntary cybersecurity framework that's coming out has this governance piece to it. Mm. We look a lot at corporate cyber responsibility and how critical that is, because the time to talk about the cybersecurity decisions aren't in response to an attack that's happened. It's beforehand. And we continue to struggle with making cybersecurity a boardroom issue, a board issue, a director issue. People who are doing it say, oh, we've been doing this for a while. But those who aren't doing it and those who aren't prioritizing cybersecurity and really going deep into how those decisions are being made are the ones who are compromised. And to your point, there's no bias against which companies are chosen. It's opportunism. Where do you have the greatest impact? So particularly the large companies and the resource-rich companies have an expectation of an even greater vigilance and discipline. The challenge is that connection to those people, to part of the sector that doesn't have the resources. So as it trickles down, you're not going to have other layers of resilience built in, like in the finance sector or even in energy, where if a large company fails, there's a lot of resilience built in to other companies that are doing the right thing. If the big companies aren't doing it, they're sort of, in many ways, the last line of defense in healthcare, in the healthcare sector.
It surprises me in a way that boardrooms have a hard time understanding this issue. I'm curious if, in your conversations with executives, what's the disconnect here? Like, why don't they get it? Surely, you know, they're reading the paper, right? They're seeing their corporate peers get hacked, have to pay large ransoms, get dragged in front of Congress, get dragged to the White House, getting a spotlight put on their companies that I think they would rather avoid. And yet, you know, we still hear from folks like you who are talking to executives that, you know, they're having trouble getting traction with these issues in boardrooms. Why?
Yeah, it's a great question. And what the answer that I'm going to give you certainly doesn't apply to everybody, because I know that there are great, responsible directors out there. But what I have heard from those who are educated is that they often defer and deflect the true technicalities of cyber to the CISO who comes forward or to whomever is presenting. And as somebody who is on a few boards has said to me, everybody listens, and then there's just this, okay, if this person, and it's not about CISOs, because I think CISOs have a very difficult job, but whomever it is that's saying this is our cyber posture, they don't ask the questions. It's not, is that appropriate? This is how we've invested money. This is how we've prioritized. And so there is a level of literacy and fluency when it comes to cybersecurity that board members really have to educate themselves on, the same way they have with fiduciary responsibilities and others. Back in 2015, I did an event out at Stanford, and President Obama spoke, there were CEOs, to look at governance. And the proposal that came out is, oh, boards should hire a cyber expert to be on the board. And that's not the answer. The answer is everybody has to understand cybersecurity so they can get beyond the multiple choice answers. They can ask the short essay, say, you know, really understand when somebody's presenting a cyber posture, is that the right one for the company? Have we prioritized cybersecurity in a way that's reflective of the business risk? And there is a level of education here that goes deeper than understanding that it's a problem. It's really appreciating what is the role to ask those difficult questions and make sure that the choices that are being made align with the corporate priorities.
I think to that point, there's a lot of frustration in the White House that these issues aren't taken seriously, right? And one of the ways that they're trying to address this is by putting in place mandatory cybersecurity requirements, rules for critical infrastructure. This was described in the National Cybersecurity Strategy released about a year ago. We are a year out from that strategy's release, and we haven't really seen much movement, I think, on getting those minimum requirements in place. And I'm wondering, why that is?
I think it's, you know, what we're talking about and looking at is there a first step in regulation? Should there be regulation? There have been different conversations about that. And what you've seen have been sector specific conversations about what does minimum look like? And in this space, the challenge is always the concern about compliance versus risk management. And regulation, the fear of regulation has always been, it's going to be about compliance. Make sure you do these things when it actually managing the risk doesn't always align with that compliance checklist. And so what you've seen the government do over the last year is try to go deeper into the sectors, understand more about what's required. The Office of the National Cyber Director just came out with the fact that they're going to update the implementation plan. So you might see some evolution in that. I think just because those standards and regulations haven't come out doesn't mean there hasn't been a lot of work with sectors. And the challenge is not all sectors are the same. And so to the conversation we just had, you know, you've got healthcare, water, where the resources are, and what is the best answer to ensure a baseline level of security. And I think, you know, the focus on some of the most challenging ones is important. But as you raised earlier, we continue to struggle with healthcare and a situation like this where the company with the most resources has been compromised and vulnerable. It just really exacerbates the challenges. And so how do you go in with a minimum set of requirements at that point? Mm.
So I'm glad you mentioned the phrase, the companies with the most resources, because I think that's an area of the industry that I think the administration really wants more from.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's important because the difference between those companies and small businesses is significant. And that's the other piece to this is you can't put onerous burdens on small businesses that you're expecting from the larger companies, but then it's what is being done to help raise the baseline for supply chains so that you are helping the small businesses do better while expecting more from the large ones.
So there's no larger company than Microsoft really, or maybe there is one. I forget what the market cap situation is at the moment as we speak, but there's a lot of frustration in Washington at the moment about Microsoft and its security approach. A series of high profile breaches have called into question the company's approach to security. And I'm wondering what your sense is of the government's relationship with Microsoft now. How are things going?
Well, I think, you know, there's been so much in the news. And I was speaking at an event earlier this week where there was the discussion of monoculture. So this idea that you've got one company that is very responsible for a lot of the operations and the digital infrastructure of the federal government. And what was interesting about this conversation is what came to me as we were talking through it is it's been a little bit of momentum, right? When you look at email and how this all started, it was about communications. It was about, you know, making things easier through different technologies. Then when, you know, the cloud came into government, all of this started to be more significant and severe. Now what you've got are technology companies that are critical infrastructure upon which the national security of the nation is dependent. And so with that, there is, you know, Microsoft's ubiquity really demands a different level of standards and expectation for being good and being better. You know, it's with great power comes great responsibility. The standards are higher for Microsoft because they're everywhere. And my concern is the national security piece. I mean, what we talked about in this event earlier was you have, you know, the Secretary of Commerce have her email hacked before she goes to China, which obviously doesn't set her up for the best negotiations. And now it looks like everything is just kind of going back to the way that it was. Mm. I think there's no greater urgency about the expectations for technology companies, particularly I think Microsoft and the federal government, than having for the first time the directors of the intelligence agencies of the Five Eyes come together to meet for the first time in Silicon Valley to say to technology companies, your business model may have started for one purpose, but you are now part of the national security of the nation. Mm. So there has to be an expectation. And the conversation around how do you diversify the technology of the federal government, there's obviously, it's huge challenges. You've got legacy infrastructure. You've got all of this interoperability. It's a challenge, but I mean, technology has some of the brightest minds. So if we really deem this to be an issue, we have to hold Microsoft responsible for being better. And then we also have to look at the diversification of the technology throughout the federal government.
Do you buy the argument that the federal government's reliance on Microsoft has turned into a monoculture? Kind of sounds like you do.
Oh, well, I think that, I mean, Microsoft is absolutely a dominant technology platform. Mm-hmm. The question is, you know, what's the risk of that? And I think the government will say, you know, there's a lot of other technologies that are in there. I worry less about the monoculture, while I think that that's important, but more about just the basic standards of what Microsoft, the expectations of Microsoft to be the best. Mm-hmm. It really needs to be excellent, and you can't afford any sort of mistakes or negligence that really should be addressed. The concerns are if that's happening internally, what's happening externally. There's just a different set of standards for this company because of its role within the federal government. The monoculture piece, to me, I know that that's a big part of it. And I think that there's a very thoughtful argument to be made about the diversification of technology. But my first priority would be ensure that the companies that are in the government are being held to the standards of national security.
Mm. I think there's a growing sense in the cybersecurity policy community that we need to go after some of the economic incentives behind some of the vulnerabilities that we see. You know, companies have vulnerabilities, consumers or government experience harm as a result, but the companies themselves don't really bear any of the costs of those. I'm wondering if you might speak a bit to some of those economic incentives at play when it comes to cybersecurity and like how you want to see them shift.
So one of the big efforts of CISA last year, and it continues to go through, is secure by design. And one of the key principles of that is ensuring that the security outcomes of technology are not transferred onto the customer, that the manufacturer actually owns the challenges. And one of the leaders at CISA that talks a lot about this says he doesn't like the word vulnerabilities because that elicits more empathy. He said, these are defects. Mm. You know, creating software and hardware with defects means that you've got to go back and you have to be held responsible for them. And I think that what we're starting to see is that culture of responsibility that's evolving. But the other piece is, while we look to move security away from the end user and the customer, we also need to educate the customer and the consumer so that they are prioritizing security. And we have to get to this place where security is a customer choice. It's a differentiator for good, so that we can kind of use the power of the purse, whether it's a consumer or a contractor, to be able to do that. Because right now, what we see a lot with technology companies is, in particularly with supply chain, that responsibility ends up getting diffused and diluted and ultimately just gets borne by the customer or the end user. Mm.
One of the things I've been looking at a lot recently is the way that folks in cybersecurity world are starting to look more at AI systems, mm-hmm. and trying to apply frameworks or thinking from approaches to cybersecurity to AI. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about the security implications of AI as somebody who's been in cybersecurity world for a long time. And I'm guessing probably like the rest of us have no choice but to start thinking about AI as well. Like, how are you approaching like the AI problem? What are some of the security implications that you think we need to address?
Well, it's a great question, because I do think, you know, we try to take what we know and apply the frameworks for what's been successful onto the future of technology. AI is different, but it's also similar. And I think being able to take a look and prioritize, I think the good news is that we're ahead of the game in AI, in the sense that we are in this moment able to still draft and craft the future in a way that we haven't always been able to do with technology. But I think there are so many elements to AI that we've got to figure out, how do we sequence what's important? And so I'm an advocate for what I believe the first piece is, really looking at data provenance and data integrity. We know that artificial intelligence is only as good as the data that goes into it. So biased data then gets biased by, you know, a gajillion fold through AI and through that exacerbation. So we have to do a better job right now of creating transparency about how data is sourced, how it's generated, how it's produced, to create a transparent understanding of data integrity. Then if we can agree to that, then we know that the AI, the data that's going into the AI algorithms, has a certain, you know, what you're the risk that you're managing. And again, like everything, you may, you know, be willing to tolerate more risk on data production than on generation and all these different elements. But that is the first piece to it. But I do think the other element that's very similar to cyber is, when you are building AI models that are then misused or however, where does the responsibility and the accountability for that come from? And there are tons of discussions right now that are happening on what that looks like, but getting a baseline framework for understanding is a key part, I think, to where AI is going to go. Because as the race for AI generation is there, and you've got all these technology companies building it, but you also have companies that have been using AI for quite a while, and now those models are proliferating. The responsibility for the safety and security of those models, we have to understand and have a clear framework for who owns that responsibility. Mm.
What do you think of the push to increasingly release highly capable open source models?
Well, I work obviously with technology companies that make a very strong argument for the value of open source. And I think you've just got to have the right credentials and standards around the safety and security of the open source development, which is, to your earlier point, the same as what we see in cyber. If we're going to put a lot out there, then what's the management and making sure that that code is safe, secure, all of those pieces. So we know what happens when, you know, vulnerable code gets out there, unsafe code, all of that. So if we know that, then how are we going to take that knowledge and apply it more deliberately in artificial intelligence? Mm.
I want to also discuss election security issues, which not unrelated to AI. We've seen some AI misinformation already in this election cycle. But I think in many ways we've come a long way on election security issues. You know, if 2016 was the year kind of Russia's attempt to meddle in the US election opened a lot of folks' eyes to what's possible. You know, today we have, I think, a bit more robust structures in place to try to deal with some of these things. And certainly technology companies have made some investments to try to improve the state of play, if you will, or make it more difficult to meddle in elections anyway. But I'm wondering whether you might step back and describe how the government's approach on this issue has changed, like from 2016 to now, like, where have we come?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2016, it was when I was running President Obama's commission, and our last meeting was in November. And the last meeting was actually, the last in-person meeting was on Election Day. And in that meeting, one of the members of the commission offered, do you think elections should be critical infrastructure? Offered that to the group of 12 or the group of 11. And an industry executive responded, no, critical infrastructure is about how we operate every day. It's about lives and safety. Absolutely not. Well, it didn't take long since, you know, understanding what Russia did and how it utilized and weaponized technology to do that, that we shifted our thinking to understand of, you know, why are elections critical infrastructure? It really was catalyzed solely by the use of Russia using social media platforms to weaponize the technology to disrupt democracy. And then that became a different definition of critical infrastructure. And so now elections as critical infrastructure, CISA is the sector risk management agency. It got that capability got transferred to CISA to protect elections. But the challenge with elections is that it's very distributed, obviously, across state and local governments, something around 10,000 election entities across the government. And so it's I think in some ways it is a beautiful way of the federal government working with state and local governments. CISA just identified election security reps throughout all of the regions. I think it's 20. And how we're working with state and local government to be able to give them the resources, empower them, protect them. I mean, I think that the tragedy of 2018, 2020 was how election officials were harassed, were threatened, and all of this, you know, the way that it got very violent. And that put another sort of prioritization of we need to create a resilient infrastructure for this process. And to your point, I think we've come a long way. And where we are right now is we do have a strong, robust, resilient election infrastructure. And it's secure because of the diversification across multiple localities. And so I'm always conscious when there's this push about the fear of AI and how it's going to disrupt. We have to go in with the premise that we're in a good place. We just all have to be educated and challenge something that doesn't seem right. I mean, it's the basic premise of security. You know, if you get the robocall or something like that, we just have to be more active citizens as we come into this election cycle.
Mm. I'm wondering if you might speak a bit to the political viability of CISA's work on election security. Like the 2020 election ended with Chris Krebs, the then director of CISA, getting fired by tweets because he was challenging Donald Trump's conspiracy theories related to the election, right? And CISA for many folks on Capitol Hill, particularly within the Republican Party, view the agency as a vehicle for federal control of state elections. How viable is it for CISA to be doing this work in that political climate, and especially in a year when Donald Trump is running for president again?
Well, I think, I mean, the good news is I think, you know, CISA has a tremendous workforce of people who are civil servants and doing good work and are just doing the work and not getting distracted by a little bit of a political circus up there, because it has never been more important for the people of CISA to be doing this work and out in the communities helping and supporting. And in no way is that about influence. I mean, if you look at, I always joke that we often give government way too much credit, you know, and all these conspiracy theories about how we're influenced, because at the end of the day, it's people, you know, 99.9% of civil servants are all doing the right thing, right? You have these anomalies that get, you know, this different types of public publicity. But in this case, you've got everybody on the ground supporting the resources. And at the end, of the day, it's the secretaries of state and it's the election officials that actually control and manage that. And it's CISA that can just support and be there. But I, quite frankly, I don't think it could influence it even if it wanted to, because it's so broad and big. But absolutely, I think it is the evolution of prioritization of democracy. And I think, you know, having been and worked with these people, I think it's something that actually the nation should be proud of, that we have figured this out so quickly and that there are so many people that are ready to hit the front lines of democracy without a second thought. And CISA's role is to support them and to be there for them, to provide resources. But I think it's unfortunate that it became, you know, the bit of a circus on this, because it really takes away from the credibility, or it takes away from the work and the selflessness of people that, you know, and many of whom are volunteers.
One of the main differences in this election cycle compared to previous ones is that there has been a federal court ruling preventing the federal government from talking to social media companies about disinformation on their platforms. How significant is that to the work of related to election security within the federal government?
Well, I think, you know, the hope is that social media platforms already have the technology in place to be able to stop this on their own. I mean, I think, you know, the ruling is unfortunate in different ways. I think, again, it's more political than it is actually driven by fact or data. And, you know, CISA's work is being able to work with the officials to have a safe and secure election. That's all being built. But it does raise the question about social media platforms and what their roles. And so there's a responsibility on them to have the right protocols in place to detect it, to see it, to do something with it. You know, if it, the fact that it can't share that, how has that been mitigated in the past? But the point, I think it's the responsibility on these companies to ensure that they're mitigating whatever proliferation of that type of information is there.
Do you think we'll have a safe and secure election in 2024?
I absolutely do. I do. I've worked so closely with the men and women across these election facilities, with CISA, how it's investing, the prioritization, the capabilities, the competencies. I think it won't be without challenges and people trying to disrupt it. But the infrastructure is that's in place is so strong. And again, it is this idea that we as citizens have to take accountability for this process. We're not asking for volunteers. There are so many of them will step forward to do that. But if every individual takes their role as a voter seriously and does it, you know, with that accountability, then we'll be in great shape and we will have a safe and secure election. And that will be table stakes for moving forward. And it won't be this achievement or except because that's what we do. And I think that is the evolution of elections. We always talk to our kids about, you know, the power of being able to vote. And that just isn't showing up at the ballots. That's also being an educated voter.
Well, I wish I could share your optimism, but I think that's a great note. Let's end with on that optimistic note. Kirsten Todd, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Elias. Great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Safe Mode, a weekly podcast on cybersecurity and digital privacy, brought to you by CyberScoop. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and a review and share it with your friends, your mom, your dad. Nobody wants to get hacked. To find out more information or to contact me, your host, please visit cyberscoop.com.